Allow me to begin with a story. A young man who has just graduated from college is going to his first job interview. He has graduated with a degree in chemical engineering or some kind of engineering. And the interview for his first job, his first interview for his first job, is going very well. And at the very end of the interview, the interviewer asks him, "And what exactly would you expect as compensation, as a salary, in this job that we may offer you? What would be your expectations?" The young man starts saying, "Well, I'd like a starting salary of somewhere in the $120,000 range per year. I would like minimum of 3 weeks vacation. I would like my health insurance totally paid for. And I would like any charitable donations to be matched by the company." And the interviewer who's listening to him says, "Ah, very good. Well, let me tell you what we're going to offer you." And then the interviewer said, "We're not going to offer you $120,000 a year. We're going to offer you $160,000 a year. You will not be getting 3 weeks vacation to start out with. You will be getting 6 weeks vacation to start out with. Not only will we pay for the health insurance of yourself, but we will cover all free of charge your entire family and extended family. And not only will we match or double the contributions you make to your charity, but we will, to your favorite charity, but we will quadruple whatever you choose to donate." Man, the young man is looking at him and his jaw is dropping and he says, "You've got to be kidding me." And the man said, "Yes, I am, but you began it. You started it." It's a very interesting word or group of words. "You've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding. You must be fooling me. Or stop fooling around." It's an interesting concept because it can mean all the way from something funny or to something serious. When you hear something that just takes you aback, you say, "You've got to be kidding me." So it can mean anything. The reason why I start this is because St. Paul makes a comment that he might as well have said, God has got to be kidding us. He's got to be kidding us. Paul doesn't say the words "kidding" because they didn't exist in his time. But Paul says something like, "The wisdom of God is the foolishness of man." That whenever God is acting in a wise manner, to us, it looks like foolishness. Like he's kidding. It's almost like we would look at him and we'd say, after he did something, we'd say, "You've got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding." Now, the reason that Paul is saying that is because Paul is aware that from the way that God is approaching us is totally contrary to what we would expect the power of the universe to approach the little bugs we call human beings compared to him. We would expect for God to approach us in a way like you've heard at the beginning of the gospel that at that time Caesar Augustus commanded an entire census of all of the world. Well, who's Caesar Augustus? He's the most powerful man in the world. He can do whatever he wants. He's the best fed man in the entire Roman Empire. All he has to do is say something and it gets done. Nothing gets beyond him. Caesar Augustus. And when we see the gods, as the Romans and the Greeks looked at them, they were like Caesar Augustus super. As a matter of fact, there was such a competition between being emperor and the gods that starting later in the Roman Empire, the Roman emperors declared themselves to be God. And so we would expect with that kind of mindset that whenever we're going to encounter God, the God of the universe, that he is going to be one big, hairy, powerful dude. He's going to be that. And then there's Christmas. You would expect that if God were to have a confrontation with the world that had rejected him, that the confrontation would come from power, that he would come and set Israel straight and do what even the Jews of that day expected. They expected a Messiah. But they were waiting for a Messiah which was a heck of a lot closer to a Roman general than they were some pregnant teenager, wasn't even married, having a baby in a stall. Nobody, if you would have told that to anybody, you know what they would have told you? You've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. I'm sure that when the shepherds heard about it, after they got over their terror, you know, over seeing an angel, because remember, I don't know if you've noticed, but every time an angel appears to anybody, do you know what the first thing they say is? Do not be afraid. You know why? Because an angel was terrifying. It's not like, you know, we see them today, you know, hanging in little, you know, pendants and stuff like that, little angels, cute little angels. An angel appearing to you was terrifying. And that's why he begins by saying, be not afraid. And then he says, a savior, a king is born to you. And after they got over being terrified, I'm sure that the shepherds turned to one another and said, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. But sure enough, they go and they find. Think about Joseph, though. Here is this guy who his betrothed tells him, by the way, I'm pregnant. And God did it. Don't you know that Joseph had to say, you've got to be kidding me. He had to say that. You've got to be kidding me. And even after he gets a direct command from God to take Mary as his wife, he feels responsible. He's the man of the house. So he's got to obey this registration. He takes his pregnant wife, and we can tell, because she was due, that she was big. She was big. And she was carrying that child, riding on a donkey. I don't know if you've ever ridden a donkey, but they don't look comfortable. Okay? This was a very uncomfortable thing for a long ride. And when they get to a place, he wants to have a place, a nice place for Mary. A place that she can be dignified and have her baby. And they go to the inn, and the innkeeper says, "I'm sorry, there's so many people traveling that there's no room, but there's a stable back there." Can you imagine what Joseph went through his mind? "You've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me." Because you see, we think of a stable as a very, you know, if you go to our Christmas display, our crash back there, it's pretty. It's downright pretty. Well, but a real stable in those days was not pretty. It smelled horribly, too. It smelled like all kinds of output from all kinds of different animals. And what they were eating off of the manger wasn't particularly sanitary left over. When Joseph saw that and Mary saw that, I'm sure they had to think, "You've got to be kidding me. Somehow God could have done a heck of a lot better than this. Got to be kidding me." And then, when it's time to return, not only do they not get to stay in Bethlehem very long, because there's persecution. And they become, believe it or not, the first refugees in the Christian era. You've got to be kidding me. Again, homeless on our way to Egypt. And we could go on with the entire life of Jesus like this. Each time that Jesus does something, "You got to be kidding me." Because everybody was waiting for someone powerful. Somebody, you know, somebody who's got a little oomph, a little self-respect, you know, like a god. I mean, you want to be a respectable god. And what do we get? We get a man who does tremendous things, but he keeps telling people not to tell anybody. And I can imagine people who see miracles. They see a miracle. They see a resurrection from the dead. And then they hear Jesus said, "Don't tell anybody." And they've got to have said, "You got to be kidding me. That I'm not supposed to tell anybody after I see all of this. Got to be kidding me." And then, in the very end, Jesus stands before Pilate and Herod. And you'd expect it. You'd expect it. Okay, now it's time. Now you're going to let them have it. No. Remember when Jesus was saying that he had to go to Jerusalem and be crucified? And what did Peter say to him? "Yeah, you got to be kidding me, Lord. You got to be kidding me. May that not happen to you." And what does Jesus say to him? He doesn't say, "Thank you very much. I am so happy that you are concerned about me." No. "Get thee behind me, Satan." And do you remember why he says, "Get thee behind me, Satan"? The next sentence. "You are thinking like man does, not like God." What does that tell you about God? It tells you that the foolishness of man when man is kidding, is the wisdom of God. And then the final scene, when Jesus, behind me, hung up, and before he's dying, he's got every chance in the world to call out for all the angels, destroy people. Jesus had every chance to say, Father, look at what these idiots have done to me. And what do you hear from him? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. You got to be kidding me. You see, the problem is that we always imagine that the power of God is going to mimic the power of people in this world. The power of people in this world is like the power of Caesar Augustus. They can command armies. They can push the button. They can build missiles. They can do all kinds of stuff. They can command armies and stuff like that. And that's the kind of power we're used to. And so every time we think about God, we always think of, okay, God, you're powerful. You can do this. And God doesn't think like that. He doesn't. You know, the closest thing to the power of God, it's just an image. Water. Have you ever had maybe like a flooded basement? Well, we don't have basements here, but, you know, a flooded something or other. And you get one of these brush brooms and you start pushing the water back and you push the water back. Does the water allow itself to be pushed back? Yes. It responds to the brush. But you know what happens after it responds to the brush? It comes around. Ultimately, no matter what you try to do, water is one of the greatest powers and the most weak powers. You can move water just by touching it. And yet, it has carved the Grand Canyon. Because the power of water does not need to be great according to how we understand power and greatness. And that's what we have trouble with. That's why many of us just can't handle Jesus. Because we still believe that power is like Caesar Augustus. It all comes down to the fact that we don't think like God thinks. We just don't. Power, according to God, is humility, love, and service, even to the point of allowing himself to be born in a stable and crucified on a pole. And that's why we have trouble believing in him. If Jesus would have been more like Caesar Augustus, he would be number one. He would overshadow Trump. I better keep my mouth shut. But he would. No boisterous, nothing. Just the way it does it. And so tonight, if you can get beyond the expectations of God as Caesar Augustus, you might just catch a glimpse of the power in the universe lying in a manger, helpless, putting himself in the hands of a people that will ultimately reject him and crucify him. And yet, that is what power is. You gotta be kidding me. But it's true.